Okay, the first week we're covering his biographical, history, geographical aspects, and just to explore Edward's life, family, historical context in a geographical setting. If you have bought your book, we're really focusing on chapters 1 and 2 of the Nichols, chapter 1 of Lawson, Resolutions and a Personal Narrative. Many of you have already seen, this is a picture of Jonathan Edwards, and it was during his Northampton days. And we'll go ahead and get into that and what that meant as well. Just to put, where are we at here? There isn't a... Oh, I guess we're not there. The other way. I'll explain those. All right, Jonathan Edwards, just basically, geographically... he was born and raised in Windsor, Connecticut, which is just 6 miles north of Harvard. This is the Connecticut River. This is where he spent his childhood. He spent time at, obviously, New Haven for Harvard, Yale University, and then he spent some time in New York, 8 to 9 months. The bulk of his ministry was in Northampton. Celia and I have made several, if you would call them, pilgrimages to the sites. I'll show you some pictures. Once he was released from his church, he then spent several years, 7, 8 years, at a church in Stockbridge, also ministering to the Indians. Some of them were the Mohicans. And then he was called to become the president of the College of New Jersey. And I'll talk about that as well. Just as a clue, the College of New Jersey eventually became Princeton University. Jonathan was the third president, but his tenure there was incredibly short. If you have any questions as I go through what I prepared, just raise your hand at any time or ask questions at the end. So without any further ado, Dr. Lloyd-Jones, when he gave a lecture at the Puritan Westminster Conference in 1976, on Jonathan Edwards and the crucial importance of his presence in revival, he stated concerning what he saw as the importance and magnitude of the theology and influence of Jonathan Edwards. And this is what Martin Luther Jones said. I am tempted, perhaps foolishly, to compare the Puritans to the Alps, Luther and Calvin to the Himalayas, and Jonathan Edwards to Mount Everest. Kind of gives you a picture of the magnitude of Jonathan Edwards' life and ministry. Likewise, Perry Miller, who was an atheist historian from Harvard, and he was a professor of intellectual American history, particularly concerning New England Puritans, was the one who really rediscovered Jonathan Edwards' writings in the 1930s and 1940s. After 100 years of pretty much complete absence of Jonathan Edwards. Again, this guy is an atheist, and this was his appraisal of Jonathan Edwards. Edwards, the greatest philosopher theologian yet to grace the American scene, deserves to be heard. Pretty, what's that? Deserves to be heard. That's an atheist. But the historian, and he died at an early age, and he recognized, just the accumulation of his writings. And even at that point, they only had just a measure and fraction of what we have now. I went to an Edwards conference at Yale, Celia and I did about 2 years ago. And even then, there was a lady that came forth before the conference. This was months, but they presented it. Her family, she never knew, up in the attic type thing, had over 1,700 pages of missing Edwards texts. And when she discovered it, she knew this had to go to Yale. There is a center there for Jonathan Edwards. As I'll explain probably a little bit later, Yale put out several volumes, more than several. And I want to give you a website, if I can, or it's on your thing, I believe. This is Original Sin, one of his major treatises. This one has several of them. I like the one here. This is the one I mostly use. You can see by the broken spine. The End for Which God Created a World. This is his ethical writings. when you go to the Yale website, you can access everything that is available in Jonathan Edwards right now, because these volumes cost $125 a piece. But he has written, even right now, not including what that lady donated, 73 volumes. That's more than Augustine and Calvin combined. The man was absolutely prolific. So, Edwards was born in 1703 in Windsor, Connecticut, as I mentioned. He was the only son of Timothy Edwards, a local pastor, and Jonathan had 10 sisters. Jonathan was 6 foot to 6 foot one, but all of his sisters were taller than he was. It was renowned that Timothy Edwards had 60 feet of daughters and hormones around the Connecticut territory. Now, you can imagine where they grew up. You know, Jonathan's bathroom was the trees in the backyard, okay? I mean, just, you can imagine what a house full of 11 children, you're the only son. But there was a complete loving relationship between them all. Jonathan learned Latin at a very early age. His father, Timothy, was a preacher who was in the ministry for 61 years himself. But he took a great interest in Jonathan, as all of his children. He taught his daughters how to read Latin. He believed his daughters needed to be just as equipped in knowing the scriptures as Jonathan. But he really felt that Jonathan was really the person that needed to be prepared for ministry. Even at an early age of 12 years old, he asked, when father was traveling preaching, asked Jonathan to go ahead and continue to lecture the sisters on Latin, because he noticed this guy had a gifting. Jonathan did. He was that insightful at such a young age. Timothy sent Jonathan off to Yale University at 13 years old. During his early years at Yale, he was deeply influenced by the writings of John Locke, his Essays of Human Understanding, but also of the writings of Sir Isaac Newton regarding math, physics, science, and theology. Many of you know Isaac Newton was a very profound Christian. I tried to read his Principia a couple times and failed each time. The mathematical equations kill me. But what you do read in Isaac Newton is really inspiring. Edwards graduated from Yale in 1720 at just 17 years old. He was selected to give the valedictorian address, and he gave it in Latin. He then continued his studies at Yale for 2 more years, resulting in a master's degree. At 19, he took a pastorate in New York for 8 months, but decided to return to Yale as a tutor and served as such between 1723 and 1726. I don't have a copy of it, but I'll make copies if you'd like. This is something Jonathan wrote whenever he was in Yale, and he wrote this at 15 years old. And this was an influence that he had from Sir Isaac Newton. It's called Wisdom in the Contrivance of the World. What a title. He talks about how God's wisdom appears in the atmosphere, in the eyeball, in the roundness of the earth. I mean, it's pretty amazing that a 15-year-old would write this 2-page thing. It's pretty, again, pretty outstanding. Also in the packet you have, if you wanted to look at them, his resolutions. Now, his personal narrative you have there before you, I encourage you to read this. This is something he wrote later on, talking about how he came to faith and the things that he did to continue to grow his faith. But these are his resolutions that he started to write at 19 years old. And he wrote them between 1722 and 1723. When you look at the first one, resolved that I will do ever what I think to be the most for God's glory, by my own good and profit and pleasure, in the whole of my duration, without any consideration of time, whether now or never, so many myriads of ages hence, resolved to do whatever I think to be my duty, and most for the good and advantage of mankind in general, resolved to do this, whatever difficulties I may meet with, how many and however how great soever. 19 years old, he wrote this. I hope to write something like this when I'm 70 or something. Like, you just look at this stuff and you're just like, wow, this is incredible. Anyway. So he's back at Yale, and 1722, 1723, he wrote his resolutions, but he made a vow, and there's a letter in his works, that he would read them each week, all 70, for the rest of his life, just to remind himself, just to track that course that he had. What discipline. His most favored of all was resolution number 6, which says that he vows or resolves to live with all my might while I do live. And the reflection of the amount of works, that's the ministry on top of the works is really what's amazing to all of these, all of this. But in the summer of 1723, Edwards met and fell in love with Sarah Pierpont. Of Sarah Pierpont, he wrote on the front page of his Greek grammar. Things never change, huh? You know, you see this girl in school and you got to write something about her. He wrote, "They say there is a young lady in New Haven who is loved by that great being who made and rules the world, and that there are certain seasons in which this great being in some way or other invisible comes to her and fills her mind with exceeding sweet delight, and that she hardly cares for anything except to meditate on him. She is a wonderful sweetness, calmness, universal benevolence of mind, especially after this great God has manifested himself to her. She will sometimes go about from place to place, singing sweetly, and seems to always be full of joy and pleasure, and no one knows for what. She loves to be along walking in the fields and the groves, and seems to have someone invisible always conversing with her." 19 years old, and that's the girl he fell in love with. Wow. I will do better with cards, sweetheart. However, Sarah was only 13 at this time. Nonetheless, Edwards waited for 4 years, and he eventually took a pastorate at his maternal grandfather's church, Jonathan's mother's father, in Northampton. He was installed as an assistant pastor in 1726. This church was, right 5 months afterwards, Jonathan and Sarah were married. He was 23, she was 17. Over the next 23 years of their time in Northampton, they also produced 11 children, 8 daughters and 3 sons. In 1729, however, Solomon's daughter passed away, and Jonathan was immediately ordained as the senior minister there. Again, this is... Okay, how old is he at this point? 26 years old. Edwards then pastored there for another 20 years. It was a traditional congregational church. It was not a Presbyterian church, which in 1735, just 5 years after, 6 years after he took over, it had a surprising 620 congregants. We're talking frontier days, folks. Okay. It's almost like the entire town went to this church. Anyway, during his 23-year pastorate, Edwards delivered the usual 2-hour sermons each week. He also catechized children, counseled people in his study. He did not visit from house to house except when he was called, and this meant that he could spend 13 to 14 hours a day in his study. He once said, "I think Christ has commended rising early in the morning by his rising from the grave very early." Edwards was known to arise each morning between 4 and 5 o'clock and entered his study, always with pen in hand, thinking out every flash of insight to its full and recording his notebooks. Even on his travels, now this is a cute story, he would pin pieces of paper to his coat to remind himself at home of the insight he had along the way. One of the letters from Sarah described that, you know, when Jonathan rode to these other towns, sometimes to Boston, now we're talking like 90, 95 miles from Northampton to Boston. We've driven that before. And that's with a car, okay? He's got a carriage or sometimes just horseback. But he would focus his thoughts on the things of God along the way. And whenever an ideal came to him, he would take out a piece of paper, and the scraps of paper were just little scraps, you know. And he would just put one. And then he would write what that thought was. And the one thing you need to know, Jonathan had the most horrible handwriting in the world. if you went to study at Yale, you had to take a 7 to 9 month course to translate his writings or transcribe his handwriting. And it had to be double checked and rechecked. But he would put number one and what that thought was. Then he would contemplate on that thought and he would go, oh, well, that means if this is true, well, then, you know, this would probably be a logical second thing to back up on. And he would stop again, write number two, and write that thought. He put those together, and one time I had the privilege at Yale University, their real manuscript library is called Beinecke Library. And some things you can actually sit in the basement there, and she'll bring it to you. And she brought me the first draft of it's not the draft of the entire writing, Religious Affections, because all those are just sermons. But she brought basically one of those pamphlets that it still had his hand sewn stitching there of one of those rides he did, and he numbered them 1, 2, 3. I'm thinking, I am holding a 270-page document in my hand that Jonathan, you know, he's just like, okay, I can't worship this, but, you know, this is pretty astounding right here. But I wanted to draw your attention to the fact is that's how disciplined his mind was, which is extraordinary. In the evening, he would also spend family time after dinner, usually retiring to a study and after an hour with his family. But none of his children were ever known to ever rebel or go astray. And yet throughout his entire life, they always held Jonathan in the highest regard as their most dear father. He still had time to be a wonderful father on top of all of this. Now you understand resolution number 6. Edwards, of course, was 6'1", but his health was always precarious. He could maintain the rigor of his study schedule, and he also gave strict attention to his diet and exercise. He understood that eating the wrong kinds of food could make him sleepy or even sick. His exercise in the winter each day was to chop firewood half an hour each morning for his family. And then he would ride in the fields and walk alone in meditation. These excursions revealed that for all his rationalism, Edwards had a healthy dose of experiential and even sometimes one might say romantic religion. He wrote in his diary, quote, "Sometimes on fair days I find myself more particularly disposed to regard the glories of this world than to betake myself to the study of serious religion." He was a person who believed in going out, we look for God's glory in all creation. And again, taking from that the influence of Newton in college, because that's how Newton wrote. You know, there is a long quote here. I probably won't get to it, but, well, I will. This is one of his narratives from one of his field walks. "I once rode into the woods for my health in 1737, having alighted from my horse to a retired place, as my manner commonly has been, to walk for divine contemplation and prayer. I had a view that for me, there was an extraordinary glory in the Son of God. As mediator between God and man, of his wonderful, great, full, pure, and sweet grace and love and meek and gentle condescension, this grace that appeared so calm and sweet appeared also so great to me in the heavens above. The person of Christ appeared ineffably excellent," who uses that word anymore, "and exceedingly great enough to swallow up all of my thoughts and conceptions, which continued as near as I can judge for about an hour, which kept me the greater part of the time in a flood of tears and weeping aloud. I felt an ardency of my soul to be what I know not otherwise how to express, emptied and annihilated, to lie myself in the dust and yet to be full of Christ alone, to love him, to serve him and follow him, and to be perfectly sanctified and made pure with a divine and heavenly purity. I have several other times where such views, very much of the same nature, have all had the same effects on me." How many of us go out for a walk and write something like that when we get home? Incredible. But the vast measure, again, of his ministry is reflected in the 73 volumes. Edwards wrote over 1,200 sermons. Most of those sermons are between 15 and 28 pages long. Now you know why it's 2 hours. And he read the entire manuscript. He wrote 1,400 miscellanies, and we'll talk about that in weeks to come. Miscellanies were just like his, oh, here's a thought, you know, wrote this down. Some of his miscellanies, like those on the Trinity, he compiled later to do his discourse on Trinity. His miscellanies could be one sentence. The longest one is 16 pages. Most of them are probably about 3 or 4 paragraphs. He also wrote hundreds of letters, of narratives, smaller works, and over a dozen major treatises like Original Sin or Religious Affections or Freedom of the Will. In 1750, however, trouble came to Edwards and his congregation. He was eventually dismissed from his congregation. One of the reasons was a tactless blunder that Edwards had committed on his part, where he implicated some young people in an obscene scandal in 1744. What it was is they got a hold of a cutaway picture of a female anatomy. Back those days, you know what that was kind of like. And that created a lot of boys start mocking girls, you know, and it got out, and he scolded them, you know, publicly rebuked them, and the parents didn't take it too well. Some people, town people, didn't take it too well. There were several excommunications. Because of the Salem witch trials, excommunication were really taboo for many, many decades. The last time there was an excommunication in the church in Northampton was 1711. But in 1747, Edwards excommunicated several people, one of which was a woman that was just habitually drunk and coming to church all the time. The elders had talked to her numerous times, but at some point, Edwards felt, we need to excommunicate this. You know, she can't be a part of the church until she repents. But it seemed that no matter what Edward did, the situation remained a black cloud hanging over his ministry. But during these years also, Edwards became the target of a coordinated and insurmountable campaign of slander in his last 2 years of ministry. Several causes lay behind this, to include those excommunications, but also the changing view of theology had started to turn to Arminianism. And of course, as we probably have all seen, there's always, in many churches, unfortunately, power plays. And this is one of them. One of the people, Major Pomeroy, Seth Pomeroy, his father was behind it, Ebenezer Pomeroy. Later on, after Edwards was dismissed, came to Edwards and apologized and pretty much confessed everything. There's a letter of which Edwards wrote about this. And Edwards still scolded him and said, you know, your offense isn't to me. Your offense is what you did to Christ and his church, which is a rightful thing to say. But nonetheless, it was a very sad affair. The straw that broke the camel's back, and this is important, was that Edwards, he publicly repudiated a long-standing tradition in the New England church of not requiring profession of saving faith in order to be a communicant to the Lord's Supper. In other words, not fencing the table. At least in the scriptures, my opinion, and it's not just me, but a great many guys, there's a reason why we fence the table. It is the Lord's Supper for his people. If you're not a believer, just let the elements go past you. Solomon Stoddard, remember, that was his maternal grandfather, for many decades, and he was extremely well-loved in that community, used it as an evangelistic device. Basically, come to Christ, God will save you through the Lord's Supper. It would almost give a Catholic tinge to it as well. But that was kind of like the big taboo. But remember, Edwards was in a congregational church. And even after he was dismissed, there is a letter in which he praises the Presbyterian system as the most rightful system of government for God's people. And he firmly believed in the Westminster Confession. He was thoroughly reformed. But again, that's some of the trappings. Remember, in that day as well, when you became a pastor, if the church couldn't afford you, guess who paid your salary? The town. Well, how can you turn away a town folk who wants to take the Lord's Supper, even though he may not be saved, when his taxes are paying your salary? Do you see the trouble that incurs there? Edwards wrote, in one of his treatises, he said that none ought to be admitted to the communion and the privileges of members of the visible Church of Christ in complete standing, but such as are in profession and in the eyes of the church, Christian judgment, and godly or gracious persons. Again, you need to be a Christian to be a part of the Lord's Supper. But during his ministry in Northampton, Jonathan achieved both acclaim and notoriety for his leadership in the Great Awakening. And that was between the 1730s and 1740s, as well as many other ministerial and church controversies. But after his dismissal, Edwards then continued to perform interim preaching, including Northampton. They had not found a pastor for years. Then in 1751, he accepted a call to Stockbridge in western Massachusetts as pastor of the church and missionary to the Indians. He ministered in Stockbridge for 7 years until January 1758, when he was called by the Board of Trustees of the College of New Jersey to be its next president, following the sudden death of its current president, Aaron Burr Sr., who was Edward's son-in-law. Aaron Burr Sr. Was married to Edward's daughter, Esther, and he had died suddenly. The College of New Jersey later became Princeton University. Jonathan was very hesitant to receive such an appointment. For him, it meant that he would have to relinquish his love to be a devoted studier, a single-hearted, passionate study of divinity. And he would have to trade that to be one of a more administrative role and relational role to supporters and everything else. When the trustees at Princeton called him to be president, he wrote back that he was not at all suited to such a public office. He felt that he could write better than he could speak. That's me. And he wanted to finish his one writing, one particular writing, which is the History of Redemption. There is a volume on the History of Redemption. They basically put together a bunch of his sermons, but that was to be his magnum opus, and he never got to finish it. Jonathan records, "My heart is so much in these studies that I cannot find it in my heart to be willing to put myself in any incapacity to pursue them any more in the future or any part of my life." Nonetheless, Jonathan conceded from the guidance of many friends, fellow ministers, and fellow academics. But when Jonathan soon arrived at Princeton, he faced also a very dreadful situation, which greatly affected the entire, not only academic community, but the entire town of Princeton itself. And that was the outbreak of smallpox. Smallpox was currently ravaging the areas of Princeton to Philadelphia when Jonathan arrived. Smallpox was highly contagious, and had inflicted a death rate of over 30% among the colonies at that time. This is a pandemic, a plague that continued all the way into the Revolutionary War. Again, they were trying to struggle with how to deal with this. Anyway, smallpox outbreaks were sporadic, but they were very deadly. An example of the lethality of smallpox during the colonial days was realized in 1721, the disease spread across the city of Boston. Eventually, more than half the city's population was infected, and it killed 1 in 13 residents in the city. Sarah had remained in Stockbridge at this time, with the expectation for her to join Jonathan at Princeton later that summer. I think Jonathan realized that he needed to keep Sarah away for her own protection. Plus, he needed to go ahead and set up a homestead and everything else. The vaccine at that time for smallpox was known as variolation or inoculation. It involved, and I've seen this, you can learn anything on YouTube, but this is where they purposefully expose someone to the smallpox matter, the matter, corpuscles. What they do is they take from the victim's scabs or the pus, they inject or insert the corpuscle or the pus into the other person using a needle or a lance to purposefully give them smallpox. This approach typically caused a simple, mild version of the disease, and it induced a state of immunity for the smallpox itself. You know, those are rough days. Okay. Remember, just a little bit more, just as a sidebar here, even when Jonathan was living up in here, these were the Indian territories. I mean, there were still Indian raids into some of the towns to steal particularly women and children to be servants for the Indians. One is another sidebar. A wonderful story I learned recently was in Virginia. There's a valley called, Darby Valley, I think. Anyway, what happened was is this guy had a homestead out in the wilderness. Indians came, captured his wife, other wives. He spent 6 years looking for her. And when he found her, she was living with that Indian tribe in this, what is now the state of Ohio. And he purchased her back, took her back, settled in this valley in Virginia. And it was such a wonderful story, kind of like a biblical story, really. Going and winning her back and redeeming her from the Indians. And to this day, it is now called, it's not Darby Valley, I'll figure out what it is. Anyway, but, you know, that just, it paints a picture of just how rough things were back then in the mid-1700s, living in those days. When Edwards would write sometimes to like people across the pond in Scotland, people in Scotland absolutely loved him. Matter of fact, when he was dismissed from Northampton, he had several offers to become a Presbyterian minister at churches in Scotland, which he almost took because he realized the Presbyterian system and he thought, what a wonderful opportunity, but he just felt like he could not do it at that time. But one of those letters I had read recently in my studies, he wrote to a guy over there, a minister, and then that guy wrote back, Jonathan back. Jonathan didn't get the letter for 11 months. Because remember, it's going by ship. It's going by carriage. Very different days than what we have now. Anyway, on February 23rd, Edwards arrived in Princeton in January. On February 23rd, 1 month after he had assumed the presidency of Princeton, Edwards was inoculated with smallpox. Unfortunately, Jonathan contracted full-blown smallpox from the vaccine itself. The pustules in his throat became so large that he could not even swallow water or the necessary fluids at the time to fight the raging fever that soon developed. When Jonathan knew he was not going to survive, he called his daughter Lucy, who was nearby, and gave her his last words. No grumbling that he would be taken in the prime of his life with the great history of redemption, his magnum opus yet to be written, but instead, with confidence in God, God's good sovereignty, he gave his daughter Lucy these last words as a consolation to his family. Dear Lucy, it seems to me that the will of God that I must shortly live, it seems to me to be the will of God that I must shortly leave you. Therefore, give my kindest love to my dear wife and tell her that the uncommon union which has so long subsisted between us has been of such a nature as I trust is spiritual and therefore will be supported under so great a trial and submit cheerfully to the will of God. And as to my children, you are now to be left fatherless, which I hope will be an inducement to you all to seek a father who will never fail you. And I believe, I'll read a letter from William Shippen, a longtime friend, and his doctor who was there at his deathbed. Edward's actual last words were, "Where is now my Redeemer, sweet Jesus?" What a testimony of a life and what a way to pass. And exactly 1 month later, March 22nd, 1758, Jonathan succumbed to smallpox at 54 years old. His friend and his physician and close friend for many years, William Shippen, wrote the hard letter to Sarah, still in Stockbridge. And this is the letter. I am heartily sorry for the occasion of my writing to you by this express, but I know you have been informed by a line from your excellent, loving, and pious husband that I was brought here to inoculate him. Your dear daughter Esther and her children for the smallpox, which was spreading fast across Princeton and that after the most deliberate and serious consultation of his nearest and most religious friends, he was inoculated with them on the 23rd day of last month, and although he had the smallpox favorably, yet having a number of them in the roof of his mouth and throat, he could no longer possibly swallow a sufficient amount of drink to keep off the secondary fever, which has proved to be, much to his feeble frame, lethal. This afternoon, between 2 and 3 o'clock, it pleased God to let him sleep in that dear Lord Jesus, whose kingdom and interest has been faithfully and painfully serving all of his life, and never did any mortal man more fully and clearly evidence the sincerity of all his profession by one continued universal, calm, cheerful resignation and patient submission to the marginal divine will through every stage of this disease, that he did not so as much be discontented with one word, expression, nor the least of a murmuring throughout the entire ordeal. And never did any person expire with more perfect freedom from pain, not so much as one distorted hair, but in the proper sense of the words, he really just fell asleep. For death had certainly lost its sting. As for him, in a short time before he expired, he spoke to Lucy, the following purpose I am writing to you. Your daughter Burr and her children, through the mercy of God, are safely over the disease, and she desires me to send her duty to you, you the best of all mothers. She has had the smallpox, the heaviest of all, that I've annihilated, and little Sally, far lightest, she has had 3 in her face, meaning the corpuscles. I am sure that it will prove serviceable to her future health. She thinks it will be highly necessary for her brother Timothy to come here and to look after and settle her father's affairs. I conclude with a very hearty prayer that you may be enabled to look back to that God whose love and goodness you have experienced thousands of times for direction and under his most difficult dispensation of his providence and under the difficulty you have now met here with, in order for your more perfectly fitted joys of heaven hereafter. I am, dear madam, your most sympathizing, affectionate friend and very humble servant, William Shippen. Letters like that, we don't write anymore. Sarah herself, who was very sick, though not with smallpox, received the letter, and on April 3rd, 1758, she wrote to her daughter, Esther, and this is Sarah, "What shall I say? A holy and good God has covered us all with a dark cloud. Oh, that we may kiss the rod and lay our hands upon our mouths. The Lord has done it. He has made me adore his goodness that we had him so long. But my God lives, and he has my heart. And what a legacy my husband and your father has left for us. We are all given to God, that I am and I love to be yours forevermore, your most ever affectionate mother, Sarah." What a wonderful disposition after learning you just lost your husband. Unfortunately, Sarah herself died just 9 months later after Jonathan, when she died of dysentery in Philadelphia at the home of her daughter Esther. Esther's husband, Aaron Burr Sr., had also passed away. Are there any questions at this point? I'm going to go through some pictures and a few stories. We have about 15 minutes left. He was 54 years old. 54. It's in Princeton University. I'm going to show you a picture. What's that? Oh, I'm sure. Like today. You could die of the vaccine. But remember, we're that's science of that day. I mean, think about someone says, okay, I'm going to cut this corpuscle out of another person, put it into her. Sometimes they would take it out of a dead person who just died from smallpox, and I'm going to insert it into your arm. What would you think? You want to pray for me? But, really, I just want to focus on his life. this guy really did live up to his resolution number 6. I did, please read through his resolutions. Realize that that was a guy who wrote that between 19 and 20 years old, read them, vowed and did read them every week for his entire life. And just the amount of works that he has produced, sermons, it's just really astounding. It really is. Again, what we have right now already surpasses everything that we have of Augustine and Calvin. And really, I don't have it. I'm sorry. I thought I had it, but I'm going to put up next week on the top of our little handout, or I'll give it to you. You can go to the Yale site, set up an account, and you can have access to all 73 volumes. I think there are 50 volumes that you can actually purchase. The others are only online. But it really is just quite extraordinary. It really is. So all the material I have here, the quotes here, I took from the website. Of course, I'm on that website, you know, all the time. But any other questions? Well, those that know about him, I think Baptists, I think John Piper really has made a lot of gains in the Baptist realm. Al Mohler and others in the Presbyterian realm, I think the one person that stands out to me was R.C. Sproul. I studied under Sproul for 4 classes. It was because of Sproul's own influence that I took up Jonathan Edwards to study myself. So, of course, Sproul's mentor, Gerstner, was huge. He once claimed that he would never do it again because it was so monumental, but he read every single sermon Edwards wrote and that we have. Edwards lived in rough times, and I want you to know that too. Everything wasn't pleasant and roses here. You know, Celia and I, when we were there, they actually brought out some of Edwards' actual handwritings at this conference in the Beinecke Library. And Edwards would wait until the wives and girls, his daughters, finished making fans, cutouts, you know, for people in the church. He would pull those scraps of paper together, and he would kind of like try to make sermons on them. You know, I just, you know, it was scavenging. Here's one for the church leaders here. again, these are frontier days here, so. Edwards was talking about a disruption in the church, what we would call session among the elders there. And he said, I can remember a day that numerous high-spirited people of our elders entered into a discussion, and it became turbulent in their temper. Once during Stoddard's day, a church controversy became so heated that it actually came to hard blows. A number of one party met with the head of an opposite party, assaulted him, and beat him unmercifully. That's Edwards' writing. That isn't the historian's writings. I'm glad we don't have sessions meeting like that today. So, again, it was a rough time to live. But let me go ahead and just try to go through some pictures. these may not be in correct order, but we'll see. That is, now it's been added onto, but that wing, that is actually Nassau Hall. If you go in that office right up there, which I did many years ago, it was Jonathan's office for a month. They still have his portrait in that office. There was some lady there in the admissions. Her name, I remember her last name is Mulwinnie. I remembered it because my Greek professor at RTS was called Mulwinnie. But this is where Jonathan came to. This was pretty much one of the few, if the only, building at Princeton at that time of the college. But his office was in the top corner right there. Let me move this up so I don't have to bend over so much. Okay. That's Jonathan, but it's great. Okay. All right. This is the location of the Edwards Church. Now, the original church that Edwards had, they tore down and they rebuilt after Jonathan was dismissed from the church to build an even larger church. That church burned down in like, that was in 1860s. That church burned down in 1949 or 48. And they built this church in its place. The first two steps are original from Jonathan Edwards' day, Solomon's Daughter's day. Now this is Northampton. Folks, complete opposite of the godliness that was preached there and everything else. The churches today, at least 2 years ago, a combination of a United Church of Christ and a very liberal Baptist denomination. They combine congregations. When you walk up the street, it is every street light has gay flags, has whatever. I mean, they are very big into this. This is like the Mecca for the progressive area in Massachusetts. It probably excels Boston. About 3/10 of a mile up the street, there is a church called the Edwards Church, ironically, named after Jonathan Edwards. And it was in 1997, we went there for a white Christmas. We were in Florida. You don't have white Christmases then. That we looked inside the church, and it was A-frame type, glass front and everything. And again, United Church of Christ, that denomination is probably well worse, you know, as theological integrity and orthodoxy than even the PCUSA or any. I mean, it really is bad. But what was absolutely hilarious was the name of the pastor on the marquee. Now, I have it on a hand photograph. I don't have it here. But the guy's name at that time was Dr. Peter Kakos. And I was like, oh, this is rich. I went and took a picture. I said, I got to show this to Sproul. When I showed it to Sproul in the classroom, he had the biggest barrel laugh I think I've ever seen. Because Kakos in the Greek is the word for evil. So Dr. Evil was pastoring the Edwards Church. But that was just a different church than what Edward. This is the church. Well, this is the site of the church that even from Stoddard, Edward, all the way until now, this is it. But the spiritual thing is just, it's beyond gone at this point here. Let me just go to, where am I at here? This is our second time visiting here. First time, it was an absolute blizzard, 97. There's a picture of me trying to hold an umbrella. The snowflakes were that big. This rock marks the meeting house where Edwards delivered his famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. How many have heard of that sermon before? Okay, how many of you have read that sermon before? Okay, I would encourage you to read it. Edwards had actually preached that sermon several times. He was only coming through Enfield, and Enfield is just about maybe 3-4 miles from the Massachusetts border, very close up there. And actually, the minister got sick. They asked someone, hey, here's, Mr. Edwards, would you go ahead and preach for us? He pulled that sermon out of his saddlebags, and he preached. Now, the accounting of that day is that Edwards was very monotone in his voice, very little expression. He would be in the pulpit, and this day he just kept his focus on the bell robe in the back. The bell robe, you pulled it for the bell. And there were great cries after a while, even shrieks, what must I do to be saved? It was seen as pretty much the start of the Great Awakening. There was a great move of God in people's lives there in Enfield that spread across New England. This also led to the great controversy during Edwards' day of the old lights and the new lights. The old lights being the church people who, this is all the way we've always done it before, the real traditional churches. Whereas the new lights were kind of open to, hey, God is moving here. Let's see what he's going to do. Edwards did support much of the new light. He was considered a new light a person. He considered a lot of it because he saw some actual fruit come from it. He saw a town drunkard that no one could get him to stop drinking who actually stopped drinking. There were other stories, but Edwards also recognized the abuses, as we tend to see, and when people claim there's a big move of God here, Toronto blessing or whatever. Edwards had some pretty stern words for people, particularly those who felt like God was giving them private revelation for other people. When you read this note in his memoirs, it's ugly. You know, basically, you are giving Satan a foothold in the minds and the hearts of God's people. That's what he said. So I think he was a fair judge of these things. There were some things that we'll discuss later that Edwards, it was difficult. Edwards owned a slave, maybe three. He actually defended slavery. So we'll talk more about that. But, you know, Edwards was not perfect either. Don't get that there's a glowing thing here. And that's been a great cause for debate. There's been three articles written within the last 15 years about that. And I'd encourage you to go ahead and read those if you can. And then also one biography talks about it, Marsden. But let me go ahead. We've only got a few more minutes here. But that's the site where that meeting house was. This is the family Bible, which he pieced together by hand. Again, he's just patchworking paper. There are no Staples down here. There's no Office Depot. You know, folks, this is it. This, they had not allowed. I was shocked. We were blessed at this conference 2 years ago. This is the actual sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. They have not let this out, not even for scholars, in over 15 years. Because it has been handled so much that it's actually starting to deteriorate. This is five and a half by 5 inches. And I'm thinking, how does he read this? Edwards wrote small at times when he needed to, when he knew he didn't have a whole lot of paper. But that is the actual text, the actual thing he read of Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Go to this one back. Two stories. This is the sarcophagus of Jonathan Edwards. Buried right next to him is the Revolutionary War hero, John Witherspoon. This is in an area. There's about two blocks in front of Nassau Hall is this cemetery. Presidential people like Grover Cleveland is buried here. But in this barred off area, this is an area called the Prince and Presidents. I really want to get through this story, if you'll bear with me a few minutes. They put Jonathan in here when Sarah died. They brought her up. All they did was lift a lid and put her in on top of him. And, you know, that's what you did. Okay. But what was amazing was his, and I'll talk more about it later, his lineage. I keep going the wrong way. Come on. This is the only person Aaron Burr Jr. He was 2 years old when Jonathan died. He does not remember Jonathan. He did not remember. Does anyone know what Aaron Burr Jr. was famous for? Two things. He killed Alexander Hamilton in the duel. He was vice president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, under Thomas Jefferson. He lost to Jefferson. He lost the presidential election because Alexander Hamilton rode around the countryside, hated Burr, and just started spreading absolute slander. And it was really attributed, that's why he lost it, because Alexander Hamilton was the slander par excellence. He really was. He was an ugly dude. But back in those days, you can't immediately rebuff it. You're not going to know about it for 7 to 9 months later. He was so offended, he shot him in the duel. Left country, that basically ended the duel situation in the colonies. And he went ahead and lived overseas, came back. He was penniless, friendless, broke. But he always heard about the great love of his grandfather and the godly character. And he asked to be buried at the foot of Jonathan. And they acquiesced, and he was allowed to be buried at the foot of Jonathan. So that was just a short part of that story. Any last questions? Yeah, it is pretty cool. I'll talk later. Jonathan's lineage is incredible. But anyway, well, let's go ahead and stop there, but let's just go ahead and pray. Lord, thank you for this time. And again, help us to learn of our own heritage, our own history, of the church, of people that you have brought into our life, even from a distant history. where we can still learn and mine things, and to learn that they're sinners just like us, and they struggle in their day. But Lord, let us be encouraged that they all pointed towards you as our great Savior, our God, and our King, who now we will gather to worship together here today at Cross Creek. Please, Holy Spirit, be amongst us today as we prepare our hearts for just that. Amen.